COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at COTA.com/service changes. That's COTA.com/service changes.
I was getting into money laundering cases like never before. There was a case where I just happened to be at the right airport at the wrong time and arrested a guy who had been arrested a couple times before for narcotics, seized his plane, worked with some investigators, and we ended up with a 276 count money laundering case against this guy. And the guy had assets all over. And I ran into him 7 days after my third child was born. And we'd left the house just once and ran into this guy at the same gym where my wife was working. And he didn't make like threats, but he made a scene. And I called the prosecutor and she's like, well, probably not going to be able to do him on these seizures. But if you get into his bank records, I bet we could do a money laundering case. And 276 counts later, I had a death threat in that case. Was over in Pahoa, Hawaii, and was able to arrest him. And so I've never looked back on those financial cases.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. I'm Murph, your host. Thank you so much for coming back every week. I appreciate your loyalty, and I hope you enjoy the guests we're bringing on. And today, we've got another stud guest out here. You see this young man on the screen here. He's a retired 25-year veteran of the Drug Enforcement Administration, a special agent. This is David. I'm going to tell you just a little bit about him. When we were talking, the thing that intrigued me, I didn't know David on the job. He's, as you can tell, he's a little bit younger than me. But what intrigued me as we talked is his background in financial investigations. And he's actually recognized as an expert witness in federal court when it comes to financial investigations. You folks that know me that come back every week, you know I can't even balance a checkbook. So we might have a little trainer course at the end of the presentation here on how to do that. But we'll see how this goes. But David Tyree, welcome to the show, brother.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Steve. I sure appreciate it. What an honor. And an honor to meet you. I have seen you in my career, just didn't have the courage to come up and speak to you.
Well, thank you for saying that, but it's not a whole lot an old man can do. So I tell you what, that's what I love. You and I were talking a little bit before we got started here. That's what I love about the podcast and our speaking events that Javier and I do is we get to go out and meet law enforcement people around the world. And it's like living vicariously through what they do. So I love having guests on here. And most of them are retired, but some of them are still active duty. You always learn something new here, right?
Well, by the end, I might teach you how to balance your checkbook. I did fail math in high school. So, you know, you get what you get.
You know, I sucked at math in high school, but I got to college. I think I finally got a professor that, you know, knew he was dealing with an idiot. And so he dumbed it down to my level where I understood it. And I kind of took off after that. But
well, thank God that when you're doing financial investigations around drug dealers, it always seems to be round numbers. So kind of hard to mess those up.
Yeah, that. And I haven't had geometry come into anything yet.
No. God, thank goodness.
So, but you can tell, folks, we're going to have a good time here with David today. And I hit him up last night. I said, hey, we got this section on the podcast called Small Town Police Blotter. And would you mind reading one of the stories? David's out in Colorado. You folks know I'm in Florida. And he didn't hesitate.
Oh, no, I would never hesitate. You could ask me to read. You could ask me to probably read anything, Steve, and the answer is going to be yes. My own obituary, whatever you need, I'll do it.
Oh, man. My head's going to start getting bigger, and it's not going to fit on the screen by the time we finish this recording. So, but we have a little disclaimer we read. You folks know this is a story about crime. We talk about bad people. We talk about bad people doing bad things to good people. Now, we take our stories very seriously here, but we never want to miss the opportunity to have a chuckle at the expense of some of these dumb and funny criminals that are out there. And that's exactly what we're going to do here for the next few minutes. So, David, if you would, go ahead, brother, with your story there from Colorado.
Sure. Thank you, Steve. So this is from November of 2024, and the headline reads, Colorado Police Looking for Suspects Who Put Up Profane Traffic Signs. So the article reads as follows. Police in Colorado are now looking for the suspect who put up profane traffic signs. Some find it hilarious, but the police are not finding it funny. Someone has put up at least 4 profane traffic signs in Boulder, Colorado, trying to get people to drive safer. Using profanity shows how serious they are about trying to get people to slow down. However, law enforcement says that person could be charged with criminal tampering if they're found. If you didn't know any better, you'd think these signs were official. They look legit, and you can't tell that they don't belong there. These aren't some handwritten sign on cardboard. Their signs say different things, including, quote, get off your damn phone, end quote. Also, don't kill any kids today, and slow the F down. Wow.
I love it.
Right? Send the message. So according to the local news, transportation staff for the city of Boulder were dispatched out to the city streets to remove illegally posted traffic signs in at least 4 locations. Boulder Police Commander Darren Fladung said, I'm guessing that this is a concerned citizen that is kind of fed up with the behavior they're seeing in their neighborhoods or other neighborhoods. So I definitely appreciate the gesture behind what they're intending to do. But again, like I said, it's a crime and there's other means people can take to try and let us know of these behaviors. Sounds like these signs weren't easy to remove either. Reports say the transportation department had to find a special tool to remove the signs from the posts they were actually attached to. Boulder police said they're currently investigating the incident as criminal tampering, and anyone with information on the matter is asked to call the non-emergency dispatch. That's the end of the article. Can you believe it?
You know what? I've always wondered what somebody should come up with something that you could put in your car that would send a message to the driver behind you or beside you, like giving them the finger or get out of the way or something like that. And now you can get those, but I never thought about putting these signs up.
You know, and if we're going to do it on the streets, I'd like to see them at airports, specifically on airplanes. I mean, I noticed they're still teaching people about seatbelts. Why aren't we training people how to get on and off the plane? It's a nightmare. And I would love to have expletives in that training, by the way. I think it would make it really effective.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You can tell that's a veteran flyer talking there because I have the same concerns. But you know what? The part of the story where it talks about they had to get a special tool to take those signs down, that tells you right there it's probably somebody associated with the auto industry, because every year when they put out a new car, they create new screws that you got to go buy a whole new tool to work on your car.
Yeah.
So anyway, I love that. I thought that was hilarious. I like those signs.
Well, I'm down in Boulder quite a bit, and I wish I would have seen one. Certainly next time I'll take a picture and send it to you.
That'd be great. So thank you for playing along with us there, David.
Sure.
So, folks, you know I'm in Florida, so I've got another Florida man story here for you. Actually, it's 2 Florida men at this time, and it comes from a county that we have the utmost respect for here in Florida, and that's Polk County with Sheriff Grady Judd. If you don't know who Grady Judd is, Google him. He's got his own list of sayings that will make you roll on the floor, I promise you. You know, one of these days we may just do a show on Grady Judd's sayings, because he is in your face. He doesn't care. He will tell people, you come to my county, you commit crime, you pull a gun on my deputies, we will shoot you. We will shoot you a lot. We will shoot you so much that they'll be able to read a newspaper through your body. Things like that. So no nonsense man here, but here's the story from Polk County this time. 2 Florida burglars took teamwork to the next level when they called 911 asking for help moving stolen items from the house they were robbing. Hey, law enforcement full service. According to deputies, the pair broke into a home and decided the best way to transport their haul was to involve the authorities. When officers arrived, the woman also asked, hey, can I have a ride to the airport? Because I want to go spend the weekend in New York City. The deputies not only helped the suspects move the belongings, but they also secured them with a free ride to jail. The duo now faces burglary charges, proving that sometimes calling 911 is not the smartest way to solve your problems. Deputies did help them with their belongings and did give them a ride, but it wasn't to the airport. It was to the Polk Pokey. That's got to come from the sheriff himself. And they are welcome to stay there all weekend long. The Polk Pokey is much better than New York anyway, read the sheriff's office Facebook post. I gotta tell you, man, first of all, it's amazing what criminals think they can get away with. I mean, that's like calling and saying, hey, somebody stole my dope, or I bought dope and it was sham. I mean, there's just so many stupid things that are going out there, but calling 911, you guys get the dumbass award of the week for that one.
Jeez.
All right. So Dave, thanks again for playing along with that. I know it's kind of silly, but it, you know, our listeners seem to love it. I've tried to cut it up before, and they asked me to keep bringing it back. So,
oh, it's great, Stephen. It does remind me quickly of a story. I was part of the interdiction team in Albuquerque, and there was a time where we helped an older gentleman with his bag. You know, we're non-uniform doing consensual encounters, seizing drugs and money. And we get a call from DEA out of Kansas City, and the same bag we'd helped this gentleman with had like 150 pounds of weed in it. Like, we were literally Officer Duguid helping him get it up. It's just, you know, so it happens to the best of us.
Oh, I love it. I love it. That's just the things you see out there. I've got a Patreon channel too. And by the way, if you're not aware of the Game of Crimes Patreon channel, just go to gameofcrimes.com/Patreon or go to patreon.com/Game of Crimes. Come on in and see what it is. But every week or every month, I have a section called You Can't Make This Crap Up. And it's an hour's worth of stupid criminal stories from around the world. And there's no sign that we're ever going to run out of material.
No.
Yeah. All right. So let's get into today's interview with David Tyree here, everybody. David here was, I believe you're an avid listener to the Game of Crimes.
Oh, yeah.
If you weren't, at least I'm calling you that now. And he sent me an email and he said, love listening to your show. And he said, I think I got some stories you might be interested in. And I do get a lot of emails like that, text messages, and I appreciate them all. I'm always looking for good guests on here. I always want to portray our heroes for what they are, and that's heroes, people that are willing to risk their lives for folks like you and me. So I started reading what David wrote, and because of his background in financial crimes, I really don't have a strong background in financial crimes. I always tried to bring in either an analyst that knew how to do that, or an IRS agent was always fantastic if you could get them, but they're kind of hard to get sometimes because they're few and far between. But David here was talking about being involved in the seizure of some bank accounts associated with the Sinaloa cartel, specifically with Rafael Caro Quintero. We call him RCQ. If you're not familiar with that name, he's the old fart that was extradited to the United States a couple months ago that was directly involved in leading the efforts to kidnap, torture, and murder our agent, Kiki Camarena, down in Mexico back in the early 80s. And they didn't just murder him once. They had a doctor on standby so that they could inject adrenaline straight into Kiki's heart. They murdered a guy three times. This piece of crap, I got no respect for. I hope he dies in jail. Just put it out there. People like that don't belong. In my opinion, they don't have the right to walk on the planet with us because they're just some of the most heinous and evil people that you'll ever run into. So anyway, that alone, plus the fact that he's recognized as a expert witness in federal court, that's a big deal. I don't know if you're not familiar with that. Not everybody gets that designation. In fact, 38 years as a cop, I probably can count on one hand the number of people that I know that were recognized as expert witnesses in federal court. So it is a big deal. But then he also talked about working over in Portugal. Turns out we have a common friend over there, a former British law enforcement officer that I knew from England that ended up in Portugal running a center. And we'll talk about that here in a few minutes. And also one of the cases he got to work on over there that involved some command leadership in the country of Guinea-Bissau. So we got a lot of good stuff to talk about today. So y'all probably wishing I just shut the hell up here and let's get on with it. So David, if you would, just to get started, tell us a little bit about where you're from, where you grew up, what your family dynamics are, brothers and sisters. Did you play sports in school? Did you go to college? That kind of thing, please.
Sure. Well, again, thank you for having me. And as you spoke about those investigations, I first and foremost need to make sure and get out there that it was always a team effort. And sometimes I got to take a pole position on the team, but other times I was just in the back watching some incredible investigators from the state, the city, federal level, and international partners. And I was always really proud to represent DEA in those investigations. But I just want to, if they're listening, and I hope they are, they're going to say, oh, he's going to take all the credit, which is something it happens. And well, I want to be sure I put it out there that, look, I was one of a team of some incredible investigators, and they all know what they did. But sometimes it was my job to brief the ambassador at the embassy, and I would always be like, wow, if they only knew that I was just barely there. Well, so, yeah.
If you don't, I thank you so much for mentioning that, because it's the same with Javier and I. We get all this credit for about the Pablo Escobar case and the Medellin cartel. That wasn't just two guys. That was a full team. Everybody in the embassy would have, you know, done anything they could to come up there and assist the teams of DEA and other law enforcement, not just in the United States, but around the world. Law enforcement is a team player. And I appreciate you bringing that up. So all you guys that are involved with that, he told me he did it all himself. So,
well, you know, we made these shirts at my office in Wyoming, and it just says one team, one fight. Mm-hmm. And my vision when I got to promote towards the end of my career, which is probably a mistake, and DEA, I apologize for all I didn't do. The concept was, hey, we are one team as law enforcement, because, you know, several different agencies working together. Everyone certainly wants to get recognized for what their efforts were. And, you know, kind of difficult to manage and explain what a good case is. So the concept is, hey, we're one team, one fight. And the fight's against the bad guys, right? It's not right. against another agency, another department. That was something I learned throughout the course of my career, watching some really great investigators at every level. And the ones that impressed me the most were the ones that allowed the teams to bask in that collective glory. Never, by the way, in the failure, but in the collective glory. So that's comes from a place of humility, because I learned so much, even in these financial investigations, from some brilliant investigators. Yeah. So with that background, Oregon native, and I apologize in advance for that sometimes. I went to the University of Oregon, graduated, and took on an internship as a U.S. pretrial services officer. So here I was 21 years old, collecting urine analysis from arrested defendants who were out on pretrial release. And I've got pictures of that if people want them. But in that capacity, for 2.5 years, I worked for judges, basically. Article 3 judges appointed by the president, and then their magistrates. And my role was to report to them before initial appearances and help the judges make a determination whether or not these guys or women should be released pending trial. In that capacity, I got to see all the federal agencies who would bring in these arrestees, and they would contact me to sort of explain their position to make sure the judge heard why these bad guys should stay in jail. And I was completely enamored by the DEA. I was just completely gobsmacked by the fact these guys would walk in with these bad guys. And I was really enamored, and also a little bit standoffish, because they were so cool to me. So not that the other agencies weren't. They all were cool. But the DEA guys, I thought, wow, these guys look like trained killers. So eventually, the RAC at the time asked me about, hey, would you ever consider applying? And of course, at that point, I was walking on water. I said, absolutely. Had no idea there was a PT test. So that in 1998, I'd just been married a couple years. I got hired by the DEA, went off to the academy, kissed my bride goodbye, and incredible 4 months, right? I'd never been to a police academy before. Trained with some of the most amazing people in BAT 127. And I was put in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Incredible work. I mean, when I reflect back on 25 years, I'd never worked so hard as I did with the teams in Albuquerque and throughout the state. Did 5 years in Albuquerque. And in that time, by the way, that's where I got turned on to financial investigations. I had a really great ASAC who took me aside, and he said, you're going to start seizing assets from drug dealers, period. Wow. And he sent me some trainings, and I really never looked back. The prosecutor in Albuquerque was great, and as far as asset forfeiture went, 5 years later, I'm back in my hometown of Portland, Oregon, again, working with a really aggressive U.S. Attorney's Office, seizing assets, planes. I got to go to Hawaii, seize houses, a lot of cars. So for 8 years in Portland doing financial investigations and just traditional drug cases where I would just get into the money. I said, well, let's not just take their dope. Let's take their bank accounts. And again, I worked with some incredible investigators at DEA and Homeland Security that helped me understand what I needed to do.
I love that. And I want to back up just a second to your academy days. What time of year was it that you went to? Were you in Quantico?
I was in Quantico at the Real D. We were commingled with FBI. It was September of 1998.
Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit warm.
It was warm. Oh boy. We had Mad Jack McFarland was a PT instructor. And there were days where he had us running in the morning and then he'd come in at 4 o'clock, say, "We're running again, guys." best shape of my life, though, I will say best shape of my life. So,
your time at the academy, there's always something funny that goes on that you don't have to mention names. It doesn't have to be you. It could be about anybody, but you got to tell some funny story from the.
Oh boy. All right. Well, yeah, I think the statute of limitations has expired. So there's a couple of them, Steve. One would be there was somebody. So we, DEA and FBI, we shared 6 floors at the academy.
Jefferson building.
Right, commingled. And apparently somebody from the DEA back class would run around and knock on doors of FBI agents, who, by the way, I think they get their badge the first day. DEA, we don't get it until we actually graduate from the academy. So there's a little love-hate relationship, a little envious. And so whoever this guy was, I'm not saying it was me, might have been, would knock on doors running around in very revealing underwear that may not be gender specific with a mask, you know, 2-3 in the morning. That to me was really, really funny. And the complaints that came in, it kept us motivated, kept that competition alive. The only other story I've got to tell you is, there's a day, and I don't think they do this anymore, where we would get sprayed with pepper spray because for some reason we needed to know what that felt like. Did that happen in your academy class?
Oh, absolutely. They put you in the tear gas trailer.
I don't think that happens anymore. But at any rate, so we get sprayed. I'd never been sprayed with pepper spray. I'm not going to admit to it. So you strip down and you're in the shower and you can't see. Well, as your vision returns, you see your classmates, and some of them are in a real panic. One classmate who, God love him, for whatever reason, again, I didn't take – at this point, you're not taking off your clothes. You're just trying to get your eyes clean from water. He had stripped down and gotten into the fetal position, was laying in this community shower, just wiping his eyes, and we just couldn't stop making fun of him. And I feel horrible admitting it. But it was a position that many continued to take in the communal shower, saying, "Hey, look, everybody, I'm this guy." Oh, and to me, again, that kind of camaraderie, that shared misery, it was before CrossFit was ever a thing. We just had this shared misery. And to this day, we'll get these messages from BAT, BAT class 127, talking about, "Hey, I'm not sure if you're laying down in the shower, but if you are, you know." So that's the kind of stuff that it just builds memories. And you take that into the field as an agent and you try and build on it. So anyway, Portland, 8 years, had really enjoyed it. Hometown.
We're not finished yet. We got to go back.
Okay. All right. You want more nude stories about showering at the academy?
No.
Okay.
Oh, heck no. None of those. But, our regular listeners have heard me say before, if you've got thin skin, this is the wrong job to go into. I mean, you just heard a great example there of, and again, it's camaraderie building. It's not making fun of somebody, which that might sound like, because that guy that was laying in the floor is going to get his turn at you.
Oh, and Steve, they did.
Yeah.
Steve, I am so proud of the skin and the thickening through senior agents. I mean, I was teased for having thin skin, and it's true. Like, I fully admitted it. I got a great story real quick. There, you know, you're on the job. You cannot drink and drive. Just that's a rule. I think it's 60 days off now, which fire, whatever. Wow. Well, I'm at home and I had a cold, so I took NyQuil. And a senior agent calls me on a case to come out on an interdiction at the train. And I said to this guy, I won't name his name. He knows who he is. He listens to the podcast. I said, "Well, I just drank NyQuil." Oh, I did not hear the end of it. And by the end of that year, I had 6 different bottles of NyQuil left on my desk.
I bet you got some at retirement too, didn't you?
I kept that. This is the first time I'm sharing that story. But you talk about, when you talk about skin thickening, right? This is, and it's really important because it's tribal. And law enforcement is a tribe. And since retiring, I've studied the police culture. And I think there's three motivations, which are power, achievement, and association. And when I think back and I look around my home office, like I've got pictures of all these things we did at DEA, plaques, and these ideas of like, it's the association. And we strive for that because you have power and achievement day one. You're a federal agent with a gun and a badge, and you're in 66 countries. Mm-hmm. That association is so hard to find in the law enforcement community when there aren't always clear boundaries and definitions about what a good case looks like or what's the flavor of the month at DEA. As you know from, you know, whether it's Pablo Escobar or Chapo Guzman or RCQ, or is it fentanyl overdoses? And so I think as an agent, you're constantly having to reevaluate and reassess what your role is and how you personally define what success looks like.
Right. It is. It's absolutely a team sport. It's the camaraderie, the brotherhood, the sisterhood of law enforcement, whether it's DEA or it's DEA working with other federal agencies or our state and local partners, which quite honestly, I was a local cop for 12 years before I went fed. And I really enjoyed working with the state and locals, and, you know, as long as you were willing to participate and respond when they needed you, if they called you at 2 o'clock in the morning, you need to be on the road by 2:15. Man, they would roll out the red carpet. They were so accepting. Most of the times, places I worked, they had better surveillance equipment than we had at DEA. Of course, this was years ago. It may be different now, but you're absolutely right, man. And bring on some former gang members here occasionally, especially biker gangs. And they're called outlaw biker gangs. Stop telling me that they're outlaw motor clubs. They're not motorcycle clubs. They're gangs. But that's your opinion, and that's my opinion, and it's my show. So my opinion is right here, right? I get to have that say so. But it's amazing that they have their gangs, and I'm thinking, do you think nationwide law enforcement is not a gang? It might take us a little longer to get our people together, and we might have our hands tied a little bit by a thing called the Constitution, but we will come out and meet you just about anytime, anywhere, any place.
And I couldn't agree with you more. And I think to your point, Steve, to the newer agents, you carry the burden of either cleaning up or reaffirming what the federal government law enforcement role is in your community. I mean, I worked with some of the best and brightest in the Portland Police Bureau, and they really, their hearts were in it, right? They're from that area. They care. And so as a fed, you have to come in and match that, even though they know your role is somewat transient, right? Because you can promote or move on or transfer.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
Probably my best experiences were in Wyoming. The Wyoming State, their Division of Criminal Investigations, they welcomed me in as one of them. And what comes with that is you're representing the DEA. But yeah, like you said, you got to show up. I watched another federal agency and they were so well loved in Wyoming. And I finally said, what is it they're doing that DEA isn't doing? And they said, you know what? When they got to go pull trash, they're out there. Yep. If it's 4 or 5 in the morning. And I said this to some of my colleagues at DEA, and guess what? They were like, we're all in. They just need to let us know. And it was, again, building that relationship through hard work, shared experience. It doesn't always go great, but you still have those shared moments. Like you and I can talk about this stuff all day long. We're 1% of 1%. If you're not in law enforcement, like I don't do well at social gatherings until I can find somebody who's either in the military or in law enforcement, because at least there's a connection. But if that's, it's, you know, if it's a neighborhood get together, I'm sort of looking at everyone's waistband saying, are, you know, are they carrying a gun? Because I live in a rough neighborhood.
You're so suspicious.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it's like you said, you know, DEA, we're the, I think in, when I was a younger agent, we were referred to by as one of the media outlets, one of the national media outlets as jackbooted thugs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I've been called a lot worse than that. I'm okay with it.
When we were at the Academy, Steve, they brought in a reporter to interview the actors from Hogan's Alley. As you recall to the listeners, if you don't know, they are continually taking us through practical exercises to learn how to effect arrests, to take, you know, take a tactical position when you're actually doing enforcement, it's surveillance, etc. So when the actors were interviewed, they said that when shot in the practical exercises by the Bureau, they felt like the agents from the Bureau had to go to confession. And when shot by the agents at DEA, they felt like the agents were planning on where to go eat lunch. And I thought that's pretty funny as far as the attitude that's imparted to you, right? Because we're all a mirroring behavior. And so when I went to the Academy, you're mirroring the behavior of these instructors and you're learning what I learned and what I've taken through my career was don't quit. Don't there give up. And it didn't occur to me until at least hearing about or being in a couple of critical incidents that that training is about, hey, if you get hurt, you've got to get yourself to safety. Like, don't be a burden to the rest of the team. And I saw that reinforced by firearms instructors and tactical instructors till really the week I retired. It was the same messaging as you're not going to quit. You are going to survive. You're going to do what it takes. And that mindset has served me both professionally and certainly personally, that don't quit attitude. It's something, it's a gift that I'd love to give it on to my kids. I don't think I can unless they join federal law enforcement.
No, you can. It applies to any situation. And, you know, this is Murph's opinion on this, but, you know, we have our books and people will ask us to autograph one of our books and they'll say, I said, what would you like me to put in? I'll just put anything in it. The go-to phrase is never give up regardless of the situation. It doesn't have to be law enforcement. It doesn't have to be military. You could be, I don't know, trash collector. You could be a corporate employee, any role that's out there, there are challenges. So if you're going to do the job, do it with a passion. You know, it makes life a whole lot more interesting and a lot more fun to go to work if you do it that way. If you don't like your job, go find a job you like. Don't sit around and bitch about it and make everybody else miserable. But when you're faced with those challenges, take that challenge head on. You may not know how to do it, but if you ask around, you might find somebody that does know how to do it. Or sit down and think about it. Do a little research. But whatever you do, don't ever give up.
You know, Steve, I remember signing off on emails for the longest time. This is, and maybe normal people do this, but in law enforcement, it was always stay safe.
Yeah.
Right? I changed it at one point, probably in 2020, and I started saying stay dangerous. Because I realized safe is kind of boring. When you think about it, like no one's watching the movie about, hey, that looks really safe. And when I say stay dangerous, I don't mean reckless. I mean, do the work internally so that when something goes wrong, and it will, I mean, I'm sure it's happened to you. I've been off duty and had to make arrests. You have that presence of mind and you feel comfortable being uncomfortable, which is what really DEA taught me through doing undercover or financial investigations, plainclothes interdiction. And what you're saying and what you say in your book is, I mean, that is a mantra, right? Mm-hmm. Don't give up. I'm drinking today from my, I'm going to put it on camera. I'm not plugging anything, but it's Relentless Champions of Hope. I was designated. I had a cancer diagnosis in 2021. And I'll tell you what, I brought that fight attitude to cancer and I'm so honored and proud to say I beat it. And my doctor, my oncologist, guess what his favorite show is? Narcos. Hilarious. So when he found out that I was with DEA, because again, to listeners, you're not really advertising this. He said to me, if I don't help you with this cancer diagnosis, you could take away my ability to prescribe medicine.
Yes, we
can. And I said, Doc, I will put a kilo of coke and a dead hooker in your trunk if you don't cure this cancer. And we've become great friends. And he actually has now a DEA shirt. He's got all kinds of swag because that was the trade-off for curing cancer. But it was that don't quit attitude that I'm telling you, I learned through life experience and then applied at DEA. And I found a tribe and I found my people, and it wasn't always easy. And not, I bet 50% of the people didn't like me. And that's okay, but we were still a tribe. And when things went south, and they always said, when I saw the way these teams would come together, I'll tell you really quickly, just the other day, I was talking to DEA out in Phoenix. And the agent I was speaking with, we were doing phone tag, and he said, "Hey, I'm sorry, we've been out with the trauma team." I said, "Oh, is everything okay?" "Yeah, an agent had a heart attack." I'm like, "Oh no, is it? Now, the agent had been retired for 14 years, 14 or 15 years. Wow. Had a heart attack, family calls DEA Phoenix, and they go out to provide the trauma team. And I said, "I didn't know that's what you do." "Oh yeah. If anyone ever calls and they're DEA," and that's news to me. I had no idea. I don't wish a heart attack on anyone, but I ran to my wife and said, "Listen, anything goes south, here's the number to the office in Denver. Give them a call."
That is leadership from Sherry Oz, who's a special agent in charge mm-hmm. of the Phoenix division, a friend of mine. And that's what a leader does. Mm-hmm. A leader takes care of their people. Been retired, but you still served your country, you served the agency, you served your communities everywhere you were. Man, I just had, you know, I have the utmost respect for Sherry to start with. She was actually a guest here on the show
a few
episodes ago, but the level of respect for her just went up another notch here, and you say that.
That's that tribal mentality that we bring, and it's just about, again, in the face of danger, in the face of, I mean, look, I watched agents and task force officers responding to overdose deaths, and they were responding to families who had lost a family member to an overdose. And I'm thinking, what training do these agents have in this sort of traumatic, really devastating, ugly, sad situation? And I watched the resilience of these agents and task force officers, and I just marveled at it. I was constantly interested in what built them, what brought them into that space where they could be resilient and not harden their hearts, if that makes sense. You know, they took that as fuel and motivation to find the distributor, to work with the prosecutor. Like, there was a lot of passion. And I can tell you, somebody who, I lived in Portugal, right? So we lived 5 minutes from the beach. You get out into the water with these Portuguese that are surfing. I would boogie board. I wasn't good enough to surf. And I'm thinking, what's motivating these guys to get into the water, and women? It's crazy. It's cold. There's large fish. We don't belong there. And they said, it's passion, man. Passion rules. And I think about that from a perspective as law enforcement, because they're hard hours, right? Mm-hmm. They're tough hours, and you're only as good as your last case. And you can do a great case, and someone within your agency can find fault in that as well. And you may not win, right? It's 9 months later, it's going to trial. You don't know. And I think it's that passion. I had a good friend from the Cheyenne Police Department, and he is the narcotics lieutenant or sergeant. And he said, you know, dope work is the only work where you actually make work. If you think about it, like, you're trying to expand your investigation, where in other types of investigations, you can actually, you know, solve that problem with 15 minutes and move on to the next dispatch call. So I have nothing but respect for narcs all over the world. And I've gotten to work with many of them from all over the world. And they all bring that same, they told me in Portugal, they call it the color of the shirt. And it's a reference to the soccer teams they support, because these guys were making €1 an hour in overtime. And I said, how do you do this all the time without complaining? They go, it's for the team.
There you go. That's the right attitude. Yeah. Wow. That's a great attitude to have. So, and by the way, Sherry Oz was episode 17 here on the Game of Crimes back in October of 2021. So she was the 17th guest we had here on the show. That was back when we were allowed to interview DEA employees, and then leadership changed, and we weren't allowed to, but leadership changed again. So we'll see if we could get back to to bringing some of these studs on here, because it's just unbelievable what's going on out there. DEA has never done a really good job at promoting itself. It's one of the most secretive agencies outside of an intelligence agency that you'll find. And so that's one of the things that we like to do here on Game of Crimes is tell you what DEA does. So I love doing that.
It's incredible. Just to your point, that's why I love this podcast, is because I would train DEA and Quantico on financial investigations. And my mantra, another mantra, was you are special agents, not secret agents. But it's really hard because we're not the fire department, right? No one claps when DEA shows up. I found when people in my career learned what I did, they would start confessing their drug use to me. It was really strange. And I thought, this isn't confession. So I think they bring a lot of guilt and shame into that interaction where it's like, man, we're putting traffickers away that are making millions and millions and millions of dollars off of the addicted in our communities. Like, if you're smoking weed, that's on you, but be part of the solution, be the hero in your story. But I think for agents, it's a small world, and they do incredible work. I think DEA and the other federal agents are very well respected around the world, but they have to earn it. You know, you have to earn it, and you have to show up. You have to be competent. You have to be humble. You have to be thoughtful. And it's tough. It's a tough, tough, tough world. I always say, you're staring at the belly of the beast, and you got to be careful because the beast you may become.
Yeah, absolutely. Good words there. It's, and I've also have a lot of people, even now, and I've been retired since 2013, you'll meet people that were never in law enforcement and they find out you're DEA. And even though they haven't tried drugs, they feel the need to tell you that. It's like, okay, I'm good. You want to smoke weed? I don't care. I don't smoke it. I've never smoked it. I never will. Please don't do it around me because it stinks.
Yeah, I wasn't cool enough to get offered drugs in high school, so I don't know what it's like either, but I hear people talk. I mean, I'm in Colorado, and it's legal here, and it stinks. And that's just my point. I don't judge others if they want to do that kind of stuff, but it is weird that they'll want to come and tell you that stuff like you're a therapist.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess at one point in our lives we were, huh?
Maybe.
But I interrupted you. You were talking about, I think you had gotten to Portland.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So I'm staring at my plaque they gave me when I left. It's just really a great U.S. attorney's office on the asset forfeiture side. So I was getting into money laundering cases like never before. There was a case where I just happened to be at the right airport at the wrong time and arrested a guy who had been arrested a couple times before for narcotics, seized his plane, worked with some investigators, and we ended up with a 276 count money laundering case against this guy. And the reason for me, one of the reasons that this was a great case in my mind was, one, the guy had assets all over, and two, I ran into him 7 days after my third child was born, and we'd left the house just once and ran into this guy at the same gym where my wife was working, and he didn't make like threats, but he made a scene, and I called the prosecutor, and she's like, well, we're probably not going to be able to do him on these seizures, but if you get into his bank records, I bet we could do a money laundering case. And she was right. And 276 counts later, I had a death threat in that case, was over in Pahoa, Hawaii, and was able to arrest him. And he ended up being actually a really good witness, and we developed some other cases from him. So I've never looked back on those financial cases. I get to teach it for ACAMS. And
what is ACAMS?
Oh, sorry. It's the Association of Certified Anti-Money Laundering Specialists. And they have a law enforcement platform, and I get to work with law enforcement and teach on cryptocurrency and teach on what it means to actually find commingled money through bank records, which is kind of, I'm not an accountant, but it's fascinating. And so I guess my experience there is when you start taking bad guys' stuff, I believe, and I could be wrong, that you're taking out the economic incentive for them to commit crime. As you know from your cases, right? I mean, how much dope did y'all seize from the Escobar organization? It's like, well, they grow more coca. So I feel like, hey, if we take their money in addition to the criminal case, we're doing our full due diligence on those investigations.
You know, you're absolutely right. And when we do our speaking events, you know, we talk about the true story about Pablo Escobar, but one of the things we show the audience is some of the smuggling techniques that we encountered. Javier was on a seizure in Colombia where they seized 10 tons of cocaine. You think that hurt Escobar? No, not at all, man. They had so much more. But what I tell the audience also is when it comes to assets, if you want to hurt somebody, you put them in jail. If you want to make them cry, take their stuff. Because that's what it's all about. Who's got the most toys at the end, right? That's what it's all about. So
yeah. So to your point, so I went over to Portugal. I was assigned to the embassy in Lisbon. I got to work really closely with the Portuguese judicial police. And in addition, I was assigned to the Maritime Analysis Operations Center, which was six different countries all working together to do at-sea interdictions from narcotics coming out of South America destined for West Africa and Europe. And that's, again, you mentioned Javier's 10-ton cocaine seizure. I didn't know there were seizures like that until I started working with the Portuguese judicial police and DEA in South America. And they were calling us on sailboats with 2 tons of cocaine. And I'm thinking, I said, did you say tons? And I've got so many great pictures of these interdictions that we were able to facilitate. And one of my favorite stories is when the Spanish took the narcotics on a controlled delivery and these two Brits showed up with 66 million euros. 66 million euros. That's a lot of money to carry. And we brought over DOJ to help establish a treaty with the Spanish and the Portuguese on equitable sharing because we were trying to, and they were very open to the idea of like, listen, we've got the dope and yes, we can seize the boat. Let's work this in both directions and take money from these organizations in Europe, Eastern Europe, West Africa, and try and take money from the folks in South America. And I got to give a shout out to the Bilateral Investigations Unit, Southern District, New York, like prosecutors got involved, money laundering and asset forfeiture sections. And everyone's on the same page to what you just said. Like, we're going to keep playing whack-a-mole, taking their drugs. And by the way, I never poo-poo that. I think it's really important that we get the dope off the street.
Yep.
And I also feel like when I look at in my own life, what's destroyed an organization was taking their money. And I'm not talking about a criminal organization, but you can think about stores that maybe existed that don't exist anymore, or platforms, even on social media, that someone else came in with a better platform and basically took the money from the other platform and who won. And I think the battle is for the hearts and minds of our communities, you know, and if traffickers are making money off the addicted, then who better than law enforcement to send a message saying, no, we're not going to allow this to happen. And I continue to get to speak with those that are in recovery and they say the same thing. You know, no one wanders into addiction, right? It happens over time. And then they're making attempts to obfuscate their money and figure out how to get narcotics. Like, who wants to live like that? And my issue is you're not going to make a profit off that. Not when I was at DEA. That was my goal. It's like, well, you're not going to I grew up in an addicted home. Thank goodness for recovery. That's what drove me to DEA.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I just want to point out one thing to go along with that. It's not... Addiction is not limited to a specific group of people. It hits everybody. It hits every family. And I've said this in a lot of places where we've spoken, where Javier and I've had the opportunity to speak to different audiences from blue collar workers to white collar workers to corporate events to politicians. If you think that drug addiction, oh, that's not in my family, you need to take a closer look. Or at least in your circle, maybe not your immediate family, but look at your cousins and aunts and uncles and those people within your family. I can almost 100% guarantee you it is. And in your circle of friends, you don't know that there's addicts because they're functioning addicts.
Mm-hmm.
But it touches everybody in the United States. And to get on my soapbox here just for a second, we need to continue the enforcement because our country has become so permissive. where we want to let anything, you know, you want to use smoke dope, you want to do heroin, you want to do cocaine, methamphetamine, whatever your drug of choice is, that's okay. We'll take care of you. Well, you know what? I had a guest on last week. You heard Ed Calderon, who was a Mexican police officer who I've had on before. And it was a catch-up interview down in San Diego when I was out there earlier this year. But one of the things he pointed out is how the rest of the world looks at the United States as if we're some kind of a joke because we facilitate drug usage through giving out clean needles or, yeah, go do what you got to do, and then we're going to take care of you. We're going to give you a place to stay, and then you go out and do it again. You know, you folks that listen regularly, you know I'm not a dove. I'm a hawk when it comes to this kind of stuff. What we're doing is not working. We still need the enforcement because we need the physical protection of our law enforcement partners, our heroes out there that are willing to put themselves in front of danger to protect us. But, and you've heard me say this before also, Javier and I are big advocates of education at the youngest possible age. It's not working. What we're doing now is not working. We've got to find another way to do this. Do I have the answer? Brother, let me tell you, I wish I did. Because I would have editors taking care of my podcast. I wouldn't be working, you know, 60, 80 hours a week on this podcast trying to keep things running. Because there would, that would, you'd be a millionaire if you could come up with an answer.
Well, I'd like to get that $1 million, Steve. So here's my idea. No, this is okay. A true story out of Wyoming. So had a really high suicide rate with adults, believe it or not. And the attorney general came and said, listen, I know you're doing demand reduction in the schools. Which I was. I was the guy going out to the schools talking about sort of why are people using drugs? Because these kids can Google anything. You're not going to scare them away from narcotics. But I sort of talked about problem solving. Because when you're 13 years old or 15 years old, narcotics becomes a solution. If you don't feel good about yourself and you're in pain, right? That's why people use legal drugs. A doctor, if you're in pain, they're going to give you narcotics. So I spoke with the attorney general. We did, and I think we were the only state at the time to do it. I brought in mental health resources to speak to kids after I did the, here's what drugs do to your brain, right? Your brain produces dopamine. These narcotics actually accentuate that dopamine release until you stop using them. Then you start using the drugs to feel normal, right? That's sort of addiction. And I said, and they'd say, well, what do you do? And I was like, I drink heavily. That's a joke. I said, no, I have healthy, I have some problem solving skills in my own life, whether it's taking a run or going to the gym or journaling. Like I was open about that stuff, but I also am not an expert on alternative resources that have been tried and true. So we brought in these mental health counselors who came and spoke in conjunction with me and gave these students, as you said, an education about healthy alternatives. And this is with the advent of fentanyl and people trying opiate pills, thinking it's a from a doctor, it's a Vicodin, and lo and behold, they're overdosing and they're dying. Because if you've ever had an opiate during a surgery, you need oxygen. It stops your heart. So we were out making not just a ploy for drugs are bad, so therefore avoid drugs. Drugs seem to be a solution in this country if you're experiencing any kind of pain. I don't know anybody that's an addict in recovery who said, no, this was my plan. I all along, I just wanted to be a burden to my family. So the idea was, what are some healthy alternatives we can provide? And I felt it was far better for mental health resource providers who actually are in this providing therapy to speak about that versus, you know, David Tyree, DEA agent. I hope that makes sense, because it was that public-private partnership, and the feedback I felt was incredible. We'd have lines of kids coming up and thanking us for providing some resources other than just saying drugs are bad. Okay. We gave them some alternatives. And I mean, we had students coming up admitting to their own addictions, which again, having those resources on site, you said it yourself. See, I think education, knowledge is power when you know what to do with that knowledge. So providing resources And lastly, I'll say, I think there's a lot of guilt and shame that accompany addiction. And as a society, we probably need to work through that and give people sort of that gimme to get back and reinvent themselves. That's just my lived experience, knowing some addicts who are on the other side, and what they speak about the most when they relapsed was the guilt and shame they felt around their addiction. And I'm not an addiction counselor. I just kept hearing that same message. Like, and I would just say, look, man, you're enough. Like, yeah, you're an addict, you're in recovery, you relapse, but you're enough, you're whole. And I think people need to hear that. Also in law enforcement, we all need to hear that. Hey, you're enough, you know, and you're whole as you are. And we're all full of mistakes and we're all broken. And it's, what do we do with that brokenness? What do we do with that that makes us effective, right? Versus sitting in guilt and shame and scarcity all the time and never getting out of that cycle.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And I think that's one of the smartest things I've heard anybody talk about doing, because it's like you said, police officers from all different agencies come into schools and say drugs are bad. I mean, even the DARE program, that's what it is. Drugs are bad. You're trying to teach them that. But to have somebody there to talk to them, to facilitate that and take it to the next step, that's a great idea, man.
Oh, well, I was really happy with it in Wyoming, and I think the attorney general was too, and it was her idea. So again, I always give credit where credit is due.
Is she still the attorney general?
She's not. She's not. She was a good friend. Yeah, that was my idea. And yeah, vote Tyree 2020, whatever, for AG.
Oh, man. I love this, because this is what we're talking about is extremely important. This is not the direction I thought we would be talking about, but this is more important than what I had come up with.
Oh, well, let's go to what you want to talk about. Jeez.
Oh, we're going to. It's I want to get into some of the cases that you're okay. involved with. We've been going a little while here. So what I want to do is let's take a break now. Everybody, you want to come back for part two of this interview with David Tyree? He mentioned to you, he was in Portugal, and he mentioned the Maritime MAOC. What's that again?
Yeah. Maritime Analysis Operations Center.
And it just so happens we have a common friend. I had a British police officer friend that I mentioned at the beginning of the show, Frank Francis, who ended up being the director there. Phenomenal organization, but there's one particular case he hasn't mentioned that I think you were involved with. So we'll get into that. But everybody, thank you for continuing to come back each week. If you haven't checked us out on YouTube list yet, if you're listening to this on audio, do me a favor, go to YouTube, type in Game of Crimes Podcast in the search bar at the top. Hit the subscribe button, listen to some of the episodes, hit the like button, tell your friends. We're trying to build up YouTube this year. That's the goal for 2025. So appreciate you doing that. Be sure to come back tomorrow and listen to these exciting stories that we're going to get into with David Tyree here. And David, thank you so much for being on the show, brother. We'll see you tomorrow.
Sounds good. My pleasure.
All right, everybody. In the meantime, stay safe out there. We will see you mañana.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.